Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, folks? How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? Welcome to the show. This is WTF. I am Mark Maron. How is everyone? Was it the first night of Hanukkah last night? Did I fuck that up again? Am I missing it? Could someone check for me, please? Is today the second night of Hanukkah? Do I have to pull out my menorah and my leftover candles from the last 10 years of not finishing the Hanukkah rituals alone in my house? Do I have a yarmulke? Yes. Do I have a kippah? I do. Do I have what you Gentiles would call the hat that one wears, the little skull cap thingy, the disc, the embroidered cloth circle that Jews wear on their heads? Yes, I have one. I don't know do any of you know the sort of cockfighting of kippahs that goes on in Jewish communities? The kippah talis cockfight that happens in synagogues across the country. Oh, look who went to Israel last year. Look at that fancy yarmulke. Oh, where did he get that? Look at that colorful talis. I didn't even know you had options with colors. I thought they had to be just black and white fabric. That's got all kinds of colors and fancy embroidery. Ooh, nice kippah. Is that a Sephardic kippah? Look at all the colors. Hey, look at that. Look at that Grateful Dead themed yarmulke that guy's wearing. How many of you know that? I've still got yarmulkes from bar mitzvahs that I stole them from. That's how you know you're part of a Jewish family, is when you look on the inside of your yarmulke and it says, to honor the bar mitzvah, to honor the wedding, to honor the funeral of so-and-so Jewish person. I have one. I did not light the candles last night, if it was indeed the first day of Hanukkah. I will try to light them, but it's emotional, man. It's emotional. Happy Hanukkah to you Jewish people, or those of you who are involved with Jews. Happy Hanukkah. I'll light them. I'll light them maybe at least once. At least once I'll light them. Today on the show, the wonderful Adam Resnick. He's got a book out. His book is pretty fucking funny, man. The book is called Will Not Attend, Lively Stories of Detachment and Isolation. It's available now wherever you get books. But more importantly, if you're tuning in and you're like, who the hell's Adam Resnick? He was a writer for Letterman. He wrote, he was on Larry Sanders, Get a Life, Cabin Boy, Death to Smoochie. We'll talk about those things because I know some of you have the reaction of like, really? Yeah, well, there are good stories behind that. And he's definitely a unique person, and I love talking to him. So that's going to happen shortly. Happy Hanukkah. How do you spell it? Don't know. Don't. A lot of options. A lot of options. Hey, whoever watched my special last night, or I'm sorry, on Friday night, thank you. Thank you for watching on Epics. I don't know where else you can watch it right now. I believe you can go to epics.com to find out how you can watch it there. I do know it will be on Hulu in 90 days. The people that have watched it, the feedback I got has been positive, but I get the feeling a lot of you can't watch it, and I'm sorry. But you can look into getting Epics, or you can wait till it comes on Hulu, or I imagine eventually it'll show up somewhere. But thank you for watching it if you did, okay? For those of you who live in Nila, northeastern Los Angeles, Highland Park, you might have seen me in a Bugatti kit car being driven down Figueroa Street between 62nd or 60th and 50th in the Nila Highland Park Christmas Parade. Yolanda, the woman who owns a building where hopefully I'm going to be getting an office, she asked me last year, she runs this little parade, and she asked me a couple years ago if I wanted to be the Grand Marshal, and I thought, like, I will not do that. You know, I am... I'm a carpetbagger here. I don't feel like, I came to this neighborhood. I love my neighborhood. I love my house. When I moved here in 2004, you cannot hang the gentrifying label on me. It was impulsive. I had some money saved from a TV deal. I'd never bought a house before. I was driving around this neighborhood with a friend of mine looking to rent a place in Garvanza. And I saw this house for sale. And I talked to the woman who became my second wife. And I said, let's buy this house. I had no idea where I was. So now that Highland Park's become sort of this weird kind of hipster paradise and a lot of rock people and our creative people and young families and people that have interesting facial hair configurations and shirt and pant choices have moved in. I don't have a problem with it, but I don't want to claim any sort of, you know, territory here. I feel like I'm imposing. So you're asking me to be the grand marshal of a parade in a primarily Latino neighborhood. I felt like, you know, it's not going to look right. It's not right. But this year she talked me into it. And it was interesting. I rode in the Bugatti thing and I waved. I was in front of a band, I think from, I don't remember which high school, marching band. And I would wave at people. And every couple of blocks they had announcers that would sort of say, comedian Mark Maron lives in Highland Park and he talked to President Obama in his garage here in Highland Park. It was like, I wrote the goddamn copy and I was almost overcompensating. It's not because I was bragging, but I was like, why wouldn't people that have lived their entire lives here for generations look at me like he's one of the people that have come here to take over our neighborhood? So the only thing I could think of was like, you know, why the president came by and, you know, he came by our neighborhood and I was excited about that because I love the neighborhood. So I had a tremendous amount of insecurity. And then as I drove by these, they would tell the story in English and then they'd say in Spanish and all I would hit, you know, the only thing I would pick up was Señor Marón, Presidente Obama. I like Marón. I like it. I think that would be very affected, you know, in an effort to pledge my allegiance to the neighborhood that I only pronounce it that way. But it was lovely. And, you know, I got to eat a nice big plate of Mexican food and I met some local politicians and some people involved with the parade. And it was fun. I was glad to be part of it. I don't know if I'm going to be parading as something I do regularly, but it was a good experience to be one of the, I don't know if I was the grand marshal or if there were many, but on the side of the Bugatti, there was a little sign that said, Mark Maron, podcast artist. I'll take it. I'll take it and wave. Wave at those kids. It was nice, and I was happy Yolanda asked me to do it. But again, I'm only available for that parade. I'm not available for any other waving jobs, just for Yolanda and just for Highland Park. And it was a good first experience for me. Thank you, Highland Park. Right now, my pleasure to bring up a guy possessed by something. He's definitely possessed by an intensity and a speed and an amazing sense of humor. Again, Adam Resnick. The book is Will Not Attend, Lively Stories of Detachment and Isolation. You can get that book wherever you get books. He's written on Letterman, Get a Life, Larry Sanders, the movie Cabin Boy, Death the Smoochie, among other things that we will talk about. This is me talking to Adam Resnick here in the garage. Happy Hanukkah.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
You know how it is. Like you're born wired a certain way, and sure. Then on top of that, then I had an awful environment. So, and the way I was wired, the environment I lived in was the worst thing for my type of wiring.
Right.
You know,
you were like kind of high,
a warrior,
yeah,
very much a warrior, but not in a typical way. you know, I know from hearing you with certain things, like, I, for example, yeah. like, I worried about everything. Like, I can remember being in kindergarten
yeah.
and in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and hearing a siren in the distance.
Yeah.
And I specifically remember, because my mom had dropped me off, and my little brothers, my twin brothers were, I think, in the back seat or something. They were babies at the time. And I heard the siren, and my mind immediately went to, she was in an accident, she's dead. I pictured her, the station wagon flipped over in a creek in my mind,
a
you
creek.
Know, a creek.
Went and right off the road.
So went off the road yeah. in a creek, partially submerged. I could picture right. my brothers upside down, my mother dead upside down.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
that's how I, and I always, that's just the way it was.
I used to get, when my, like, when my parents left town, I guess it was 1970. So I'm like seven, right?
Uh-huh.
Six or seven. And they went away to the Orient. Which you don't call it anymore. I guess Japan, China, Hong Kong.
Yeah.
They took a trip and they left me with this old Latino woman who cleaned the house.
Right.
And she was horrible. Well, she was okay. But the problem was I got so sick and nauseous because I kept picturing the plane going into the ocean.
Yeah.
So it was just pieces of a plane. And I would just wait for the call that they didn't find the plane.
That is so me. I mean, and my parents rarely traveled.
And I got
once
sick,
in a blue
physically
you get
sick.
Physically sick, yeah. That's the thing I think that I'm a little different than some people. I think neurosis it is. It's like snowflakes or whatever.
Yeah.
Like it's always slightly different. I was never, I never had a Woody Allen kind of neurosis. My biggest,
never cute?
What has never cute and not Jewy, really. It really didn't have that Jewish angle because my family wasn't really like that, you know? Although that's still in you. It's in you kind of, you know?
Well, do you fight it?
I mean, No, I did. I didn't. I will tell you, I did always lean towards, like, Gentile kids, the few friends I had, because I wasn't a person who really sought out friends.
Well,
but
I noticed that with your sister-in-law, like, in the book, there was a reference to Christmas, so I didn't know if your wife was not Jewish.
She's
or
not Jewish, and okay. I could not have married a Jewish woman. It's
I tried it.
See, that would be bad. My wife, her complete lack of neurosis. Here's my wife.
Does she have the temperament of, like, an animal trainer?
In a way, I mean, yeah. Although I think I'm turning her into an animal. I mean, it's just, you know, like, no, just in the sense that I couldn't, no day at the beach.
I feel that.
But she's, you know, here's my wife's, Lori's, yeah. way she lives. It is, she doesn't think about the past. She doesn't think about tomorrow. The day that she's in is the day, and it's a good day always.
Really?
Because, yeah, very Gentile that way. And that kind of calms me down, and I'm fascinated. Although sometimes...
How often do you fight it, though? It's not good. Today
I have to try to make her say, you know, you got shit inside you that you don't want to fucking learn about. You don't want to know about.
Is that a daily thing?
Semi. I don't know. So it comes. I mean, look. I will say this. You know, any arguments we get, and it's all. It's always me being wrong. I'm an ass. So I'm just. I think we're similar in a lot of ways because I fight. I get angry a lot, which is part of it. And I think that was part of the environment growing up. I'm very. Because my dad was so high strung, and so I'm like always.
The book is really funny and really honest, but like unlike some memoirs, you know how to end a thing. You know, because sometimes you don't go for the joke. The jokes are, you know,
right.
earned, and there's a couple, like there was a few moments where I was like laughing out loud a lot, but like sometimes with us with funny people, when you get to the end, it's sort of. It always has a little bit of emotional resonance, you know. You know how to end things.
Well, that's
good.
How, you know. It, at times, I would, if I was writing it, I would resist some of the fun. If I was something that was really funny that I thought, and I never thought about in terms of jokes.
But you're a joke writer, so it's hard. You have the muscle.
Yeah, I don't even the joke. Yeah, I just think I have the muscle. I have always been sort of. I think looked at things humorously, but nothing like a class clown, and had no interest in comedy or anything. But I was. So anyway, the book, there's times where I would actually think that's almost too funny, and I would feel like it was...
It's very much in my voice.
Yeah. But I also knew, oh, well, that will help sell it too. But I really didn't want it to be... I don't like to think of it as a comedy book or a humor book, which I understand that's how people will... that's why people enjoy it. I read a lot, you know, that people... find it very funny, but to me it would, and it's not that I don't realize I'm describing things that are funny, and I describe them in a funny way, but you know, that stuff is it was hard,
painful.
Some of it was painful to
horrible.
Think back on.
Well, you talked about your father, and I don't want to cut you off, but I'm
no,
gonna
sure.
because like late in the book there's this one bit of information that's dropped in a piece that's late into the book where, you know, your father's life or what he came from becomes very defined. And it was just this moment where, you know, his father or grandfather was a rabbi mm-hmm. who came to this country, and because they were of a certain class of Jew, right. could not find a congregation or practice and was correct. Forced into working in a butcher shop.
Yes.
And then he grew up in poverty, at being the son of a first generation immigrant
yep.
who had status and prestige in the community. And then, you know, the American experience with him was just, you know, fighting his way just to maintain himself and his identity. And it had nothing to do with being Jewish necessarily, but what he comes from is pretty fucking Jewish.
Exactly. In the worst way. And it ruined my dad. My dad, you know, is, had a lot, you know, he is a chip on his shoulder about my
great
family,
character, by the way.
Thanks. Well, he is. He's a great.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, he is.
And how old is he?
He's like 91 right now.
He's a fighter, right?
He absolutely. He's a tough. Yeah, and so, but the Jewish. My whole life, even growing up, was like those goddamn Jews, you know. And it's not. He's not a self-loathing Jew, but he's. What happened was he would say they ruined his life, you know. And his father. Peasant stock, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
they were not
I know what it
a
is.
Big thing. So he came in and, you know, and had that whole Lower East Side experience
right.
and getting in fights and learning how to fight and becoming, you know, really tough, you know. But he, and the fights were always about, you know, him being a Jew. You know, the kids were, everyone was starving then, as he describes. Everyone was pissed off in those slums, you know. So his father, my grandfather, who I vaguely remember, there was no love in the family from him or his mother. They didn't express love. They were dirt poor. He didn't have like a temple that he was a rabbi in. They were little satellites. The other Orthodox Jews would come to their tenement, the little
but I'm
dump
talking about
the
that,
room they lived.
Where they came from, where is it, Russia?
Yeah, Russia. Yeah, they came from Russia. And they would, my grandfather, I think, was also a hard guy to get along with, but they made things like my dad had a
dog. But wait, they had services?
It was like a little, from what I understand, in his little rat hole in the tenement building where they had some of my other relatives living, there'd be like maybe half a dozen or so Jews, other Russian Jews that would come, and he would conduct, I guess, some kind of a service in there.
I see. I come from Russian Jews on my father's side, and it's been interesting when we talk about this that you never hear about poverty, you know, especially those fucking, you know, that Lower East Side sweatshop, all white immigrants, really.
Yeah.
A lot of them Jews, and you don't even like think about it. But at that time, I think you were going to get to it, is that there was a class structure within Jews, like German Jews.
My dad points that out, and I think I mentioned in the book. Yeah, you're exactly what you're saying, you're about to say.
Yeah, the German Jews are the worst.
They look down on the Russian Jews. My dad was the thing where, like, I think he might have went through a period where he was defensive about being a Jew, but the Jews were so bad to him. The stories he would tell about, he had a dog that he loved when he was a little kid, and they would just tell his father, the rabbi, you know, rabbi should not have an animal in the house. So he had to get rid of his dog.
Yeah.
My dad, you know, became pretty good at basketball. This is when they moved away and stuff. Then it was about and football. He wasn't allowed to play in the Sabbath. He just said, you know, everything is they drove my father nuts. They drove my grandfather nuts. They, you know, the good grandfather that I think I mentioned in the book, he would come in, they bring a live chicken back in the old days, I guess, and the Jew, and they bring it to the
rabbi.
I don't know how to pronounce it for what that butcher was. So he used to kill it in that, you know, sort of traditional Jewish, all that shit. And so they bring the chicken in, and then they would drive him nuts. Then he'd come back, you know, all right, so come back and get your chicken. It'll be ready to go around 5 o'clock. And they come in, my dad would be, and those fucking Jews, every time they walk in, he'd bring their chicken out. This is not my chicken. My chicken was much larger than this chicken. They drove my poor grandfather nuts. So this is the shit that my dad talks about.
So your dad's like a James Caan style Jew.
I guess not. I mean, James Caan, pretty wild. My dad was
tall, big.
Oh yeah, muscular, tall.
Yeah.
Very handsome when he was. I mean, he was a good looking guy.
Your mother was a Jew too?
Yes, but she was more of a very relaxed. They didn't have, I guess, Reform Jews then, but that kind of her side of the family, they were almost Gentile in the sense of their disposition, but they were, you know, Jewish, you know, and they, I guess, lightly practiced Judaism. My dad was forced to practice this crazy Orthodox Judaism that, from what I understand when I talked to him, that even his parents got no comfort in. They were born into it. It was going through what they had to do. It brought them no comfort. His mother apparently is a woman who never smiled. My dad was just a lone wolf. He had a brother and sister who didn't like him. No love from his father, a little bit of not very demonstrative love from his mother, and he had to go out in the street and get taunted, and he learned, you know, to fight back. And he, as he said, you know, if they came at me in a gang and they got me, I'd remember and I'd get them one at a time. You know, I mean, I'd wait for a guy for 1 year. I'd wait for him and I'd have a fucking brick and I'd remember that. And I would just go. And so he was eventually run out like a social worker. Okay. The mothers used to come to my grandmother's tenement doorstep with bloody shirts and stuff and say, look what your son did. So eventually like a social worker came and said, he's either going to end up in jail or in the electric chair. You got to get the fuck out. So then they moved to Englewood, New Jersey. It was about the most awful
Jersey.
Child.
Yeah, I remember it. Yeah, that's where mine are from.
Oh, really? Yeah.
The Jerseys. From Morris County.
Yeah.
Compton Lakes. I remember that shit. Did you live in Jersey?
No. Harrisburg.
All Harrisburg.
Yeah, Pennsylvania.
You ended up in Harrisburg and your dad was in the insurance racket.
Right, yeah. He got to Harrisburg, I guess, when he was in like, 10th or 11th grade.
So he's actually a little older than my parents. How old are you?
I'm 55.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm 52. All right, so you're going through life with these, like, with what, three older brothers? Two.
Five. No, I have three older ones, two younger ones.
And the older ones were just, it was just complete chaos in the house at all times.
It was awful.
The one about your brother, the one who steals, is hilarious.
That's constant. No, my heart was, I'm sure, you know, beating too fast through my entire childhood. I just could not wait to get out of there. But it totally, like I said, you know, you're born with a certain amount of damage, and we'll never know that whole nature versus nurture thing.
Never.
But I was in the worst environment for what I was wired for. And my wiring was purely my father's side, crazy, inbred Eastern European Russian peasant stock.
Anger and panic.
Anger and
I do the
panic,
peasant stock too. I don't think, see, people don't fucking, you know, really talk about this, but maybe it's such a Jew thing. Like, I believe there's, you're either like the professor composer Jew, you're the, you know, the guy who lifts things and can do sports, kinda.
No, I think about it all the time.
We're like hybrids, you and
yes.
I.
Yeah, I at my dad's side, at both sides, I think there's no, but especially my dad's side, there was nothing cultural, nothing. There was nothing artistic I can tell on my dad's side of anything.
Because people forget that there were Jewish cops, Jewish butchers.
Yeah.
I remember when I worked at a Jewish deli, Shelley, the guy who owned it, says, you know, that's Bernie, the contractor. I'm like, what, he builds things? He's like, no, he's in the mob, stupid.
Yeah.
Like, and then you realize, like, oh my God, a lot of the mob were Jews.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And I don't know why I'm saying this proudly. We get around.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Don't
pigeonhole
us.
That's right.
We've killed people. Look at Israelis. Yeah. But they're a whole different thing. I don't know what even to deal with the Israelis. But
that is amazing, the Israelis. I mean, Israelis.
Yeah, it's all frightening to me. Yeah. But you and I seem like, you know, very similar in what we come from, and similar in rage, and similar in, and your brain seems to be going a little faster than mine, but it probably always did, because I would immediately get into almost a coma. Like I'd get panicked, and then I'd freak out, and then I'd fall into myself,
I would do. Yeah,
exhaust myself.
Are you good with? See, the thing is, but you turn here's you know again the way. Everyone that it's similar and there's different things. When I'm in the height of panic or worry or something like that, I can't work. You seem through your, because of doing stand-up and everything, you use that shit and throw it into your work. Now, in my book, I put it into the, you know, it's in the book. However, I can't really work when I'm in that state. I shut down and I feel my imagination goes away. My everything goes away. I'm just depressed and fucked up and I can't. So I have to have a little bit of I have to be feeling kind of a little bit of good, which for me is, you know, a very
And that's what the medicine does. Part. What's it called again?
No, it doesn't do it all the time. There's something called Provigil. What it is, and I take it every now and then. Like I said, I'm an anti-drug guy, anti-psychiatry guy. I was never into that shit. I didn't, you know, even...
You're anti-psychiatry?
Well, no, here's the thing.
How did you break that down, though? So you, like let me just add, because I have similar thoughts.
All right.
So you look at psychiatry, philosophy, religion, all trying to answer the same questions. None of them a science, really.
Right.
So in psychiatry, sometimes, you know, in your mind, you're like, well, maybe it's a science, and they're making more progress in understanding the brain on a cognitive level. But when you say psychiatry, you mean I'm not going to sit with a guy and tell him my problems. Because your father didn't like that.
I grew up in Harrisburg. I didn't know I don't think there was any psychiatrist in town. I never knew a single person. You didn't do it. And in my family.
So there's the next class
my
up.
My family, you would never do that. My dad would see that as like, you know, first of all, it would never even come. You know, it would never even enter anyone's mind. We didn't talk about psychiatrists, and it would probably be seen as a very weak thing to go to a psychiatrist.
But it's interesting because it's a class thing.
Yeah.
That, you know, that you were like, not unlike my grandfather, Not my father. My father, you know, got out somehow and moved up. But my grandfather was a bookkeeper, and there was a class of Jews that was, it was that first middle class that wasn't really that moneyed. And it wasn't until they really sort of moved out of New York into real suburbs. So in that community, because in the community I grew up in, or I think it's a generational thing, because you're like, your dad's generation is really probably my, the tail end of my grandfather's generation.
Right. Yeah. My parents had kids late. Later in life.
So no psychiatry for you.
And not until I did eventually, though. Now, that's what I'm saying. I got to a point, I was doing this show for HBO that I had, it only did 8 episodes.
What was that?
It was called The High Life. It was a mix. I did it for a Letterman's company. Some of it came out okay. But I was, I'm not a real fast writer, you know what I mean? And I found myself in a situation where I didn't have enough support in general on the show, and it was all on me, and the dates were coming, and the scripts were due, and I wasn't happy, and I had to write, and I'm not a person who can just quickly rewrite shit.
Yeah.
I can rewrite it. I can do it.
Yeah.
But if I'm looking down the barrel of like, hey, we need those 5 episodes next Wednesday, then I was in a blind panic. And so I had a friend who
could not work,
panic attack. And this is
couldn't breathe.
Post cabin boy. You know, it's weird. My panic attacks never get to that degree. They're just something that I can feel it in my stomach, and I just feel, you know, my head shuts down, and I just realize, you know, I was over my head. It was post cabin boy too, where I talked to a friend of mine who I knew saw a shrink. I said, "You have a shrink? Because I have to talk to someone. I need, you know, I really, because I have to get this fucking work done." And so that's how I first started. So
you're in crisis.
Yeah, crisis. It was the worst for me. It was it was really a frightening moment. And then so I eventually started seeing this guy who I liked. I saw him for many years and then stopped seeing him. But he got me on antidepressants, which took a long time to start to work, you know, because you taper up slowly.
Were you depressed?
I think depression and anxiety is what I have, but also I can't, whatever it is where you can't stop thinking. That's why meditation, which I've tried, it's like ridiculous. I'm never going to be able to clear my head. I believe some people can do it. Not me. I can't focus just on my breathing. And so antidepressants have been helpful for me. They haven't cured me, but if I've had, like, you know, a wide amount of anxiety, it's now, you know, a little less than that. They've had no, I can tell that I don't think there's been any effect on my creativity. Maybe I'm a little slower in how fast things come to me. But,
see, here's what happens to me is, like, I get to that point of paralysis, or I get, like, overwhelmed, and eventually some fighting part of me is like, well, you're just going to have to dump this into the world in the form of anger.
Yeah.
And get into the present. Like last night, I went into 2 sets at the Comedy Store. I hadn't done comedy in a couple of weeks, and I was like, thank fucking God I got it, some of it out. And I feel better today, but I was about to yell at my girlfriend. I was about to fucking, you know, I wanted to unload on somebody.
Yeah, I'm like, I got.
You go right in with it?
I got anger shit, but it's not, I don't, it's interesting because I've never wanted to be, I never saw myself as a performer. I never thought I would do anything. I wasn't interested in comedy.
Well, how did it happen? So you're in high school, you're falling into yourself, you're full of panic, you got brothers, it's a terror in the house, it's unlivable.
Yep.
You become an insurance
salesman briefly.
In a very beautiful bit of a nice portrait of the end of a certain type of man and industry.
Do you really, I really think that, you know, that post-war feeling, there was still a whiff of it right up until even the early to mid 80s. And then things started to change rapidly. When I started at Letterman, we were on typewriters. When I left, they were just wheeling the computers in, you know, and then, you know.
Isn't that weird that it's like that? It's not that long ago. And like,
it wasn't. No, that's the thing. That's what, for me especially, and I think for guys our age, but it affects me. Like, I am, it fucks my head up that I was lived in 2 distinct worlds. You know what I mean?
It's weird.
I
think, now, if you lose your phone, you don't even know who you are for. It's like the worst thing that can happen. And I had the first.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. I had the first Macintosh computer. I bought it in college. I was one of the first people to buy it. And I really just bought it as a word processor. It wasn't much good anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it was a 127 something, that big box.
The thing. Yeah,
like, I bought that.
Came,
like,
with a carrying case, but it was a machine. What are you going to carry?
Yeah, yeah. Where are you going with that? It was a big idea.
Yeah.
And no one's seen it before. And I had one.
Really?
I remember I had one. And I remember what it looked like when you typed and I just used it to type and store things.
Yeah.
But the idea that you could choose your font was like, oh my God. God.
Right, right. I know. It was, yeah, I didn't
and that
get
was,
it.
Yeah, yeah. That was like 1986, probably 85, right?
See, I didn't get my first computer till probably 90.
Well, they were useless.
Get a life or something.
There was
yeah.
no, I mean, you just needed a word
well, that's
processor.
What I don't get. Yeah, I bought, it was considered a laptop. It was a Toshiba. I got it out of here at this
I had one
here.
Of those.
Remember the place called? It was the Writer's Computer Store. Is that still here?
The Toshiba Tank?
It was like a gigantic gray thing, also with a carrying case. But here's what I find fascinating is, especially the early internet days, like when I first... got my first AOL account. That probably was in the mid-90s, you know, or something like that. But I...
Right, right.
It was so fucking slow, and everything on the internet is slow, but we like... Why didn't... We knew the concept of speed. Why weren't we saying, well, this is bullshit technology? But we were into... How did we not understand
we
or
were
realize,
waiting for something
yeah,
amazing.
That realize how slow it was and say, this fucking... What's so great this, about doing this? It's just slow.
The sound of that dial-up
modem. That dial-up, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it'd be incomprehensible yeah. to wait... But now, like, it hasn't helped anything. It's just made everything move faster, made our we have adapted to it, so our expectations are equally as fast, yeah. and they usually get met, and then you just go crazy.
Well, the main thing is, I agree, for start out, the idea of word processing, so there's no more whiteout or mm-hmm. that tape that I used to put on to
oh,
write.
Oh, yeah, whiteout was
so
crazy.
That shit, so it's like, wow, you can just do backspace. Yeah. You know? So for it did become, I don't know how I could have written... moving really in a way long form stuff or even this book if I was putting a sheet of paper into a typewriter.
How did people do it?
I don't know.
They had more skills. They weren't as sloppy. Everything's
Robert
got very
Town
sweet.
Wrote Chinatown on paper. How
on
know
paper.
Did I be revising it and fucking it up and everything?
I'm sure there were revisions, but I'm sure there were assistants.
He was able to do it.
Right, and there were people that helped and there were people that retyped, I have to assume, but you still had to have that basic skill and you had to be pretty solid. I mean, it's like random. I don't have any typing. Like I've gotten the way I do it, but it's very erratic.
Right, yeah.
And I'm always going to fuck up. But the entire culture is not capable of editing properly anymore. Everything just falls through the cracks. No one gives a fuck. Even with computers, they can't spell my name properly and they misquote and things are sloppy.
Yeah,
because now, as opposed to not really knowing how to do it yourself, you just have an army of fucking 18-year-olds to 22-year-olds who are in like low-paying or no-paying positions that they give the editorial work
right,
to.
Right, right, right. Yeah,
it's fucking disaster.
Yeah, I know. I'm telling you, we're circling the drain. There's nothing
no
good.
Doubt.
I hate, I really
the drain on this,
the time
on this
that
level,
I'm living in.
On this, yeah, but we're circling the drain in this weird sort of it's a hyper real place, like the place where all the information runs around that makes us crazy that we act in relation to.
Right, right.
That's all that can all be turned off.
And
you can still go somewhere and sit and live a quiet life if you want, but it's a paralyzing fear. I like to think we're circling the drain, but I think sometimes it's like, hey, if I just shut everything fucking off and really did it for like a month, I'd be like, oh, we're not circling the drain. That thing's circling the drain.
Yeah. But you notice, I don't know about you, I can't,
you
as
can't
much
separate.
As I want to turn it off, I can't even try that, which, you know, people suggested to me, that ad, or the other thing in your computer where it limits your time on the internet so you have to work. I tried that once, I'm like, fuck this, I want to get back and, you know, procrastinate some more. How do I disable this fucking thing?
Oh, God, wait. What it's done, all it's done is it's enabled everyone to sort of, you know, masturbate, literally masturbate for hours and hours, one way or the other. That's all it's facilitated, this like mental and actual masturbatory, you know, freedom that no one ever thought they'd have. I can sit and waste my entire day filling my head with bullshit or looking at people fucking any way I want and just fucking burn a day. That's the big leap forward.
And buy a lot of shit that you don't want, which temporary pleasure.
I'm not like that.
Amazon Prime a little. And it's a procrastinate. Oh, Aguirre, the Wrath of God is now on Blu-ray. Shit, gotta get that. You know,
so that's what you do as opposed to just masturbate all day.
I think so.
Yeah, because then it's sort of the same thing. It's like I just bought a thing, and it's gonna come. Like, should I pay the extra $5 to have it tomorrow?
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
I know. That's exactly. It's totally. Yeah, and it's shit that you don't need. Like, look at this. This is kind of cool. These little mini computer speakers for your laptop. I can just throw them in my bag. What do I need it for?
You don't.
Like, I'm gonna have a fucking concert hall sound in my hotel room.
It's not gonna be that good a sound
to listen. Yeah, right.
It's not even gonna be that good. That's the hope.
Yeah, right.
It's like these are the new things, and you're like, no, it's not as good. Yeah. It's just the same. But okay, so let's go through how you got involved with writing. So you're kind of nuts, and you wanted to get out of the house. You did the insurance sales thing, because this book really doesn't. It sort of stops at the, you know, in a way, you don't cover the career.
No, it's interesting. It was never. Although I said to myself, I'm not going to do it. I just never would. I didn't want to talk at all about. There's nothing I hate more than talking about the business. And I don't leave. This is the thing. You know, my family, my parents, everything. It's always like they never know what I'm doing. I don't like to talk about it. I don't want to talk
about
it.
Did anyone get hurt by your book?
Yeah, there was some. Yeah, I. Yeah, there's some problems. There's still sort of some, but you know something.
What brothers?
But, yeah, and also my sister-in-law, which I think thinks that have cooled out. That was the Disney chapter.
That's a hilarious chapter. Yeah. But that didn't sound like it was good going in.
No, but my wife, who's great, it was her sister. You know, I.
But did you let your wife read that?
Yes,
shit?
I absolutely did, and I said she just loved it. She goes, "No, you got to put it in. She'll be fine with it. She has a good sense of humor." But there were some things I said. Just mark anything they think is too much that maybe I should chop out, you know, and then she, you know, brought it back to me with all this bleeding red. You can't say that. You can't say this, you know? So at the end of the day, I really didn't think, I thought, oh, because my sister-in-law, she's not, she, you know, I thought, oh, should I be cool about it? But then, you know, something, you justify the shit. Because then I thought, I said to Lori, my wife, you know, I said, you know something? If anyone did that to me, I would fucking kill them. You know what I mean? Just as it is, I have the thinnest skin imaginable. So in that sense, I'm a piece of shit. You know what I mean? But it's something I had to do. And not only that, it was real. It was true. It says a lot about who I am. And in most of those stories, if not all of them, I think I come off as the biggest asshole.
I feel the same way.
You read some reviews as people that don't, just like, what a fucking asshole, you know? And the things he says about Disney, or the thing he, you know, does this and that. Or
Well, I had the same issue but what I realized, and it sounds like you learned a lesson as well, somehow, that you probably wouldn't do it again, is that, you know, it's a weird lesson when you're self-involved and you're like, this is my life. These are people in my life. I'm the underdog in this. I look like a horrible thing. But what you forget is that the people you're writing about, especially in this culture, and especially, you know, in the circle of people that you run, they're just as self-centered as you are. So what they're going to do is they're going to see it and they're going to be like, how embarrassing, this whole book's about me, basically, you know, and now, like, you know, everyone's going to read this about me.
Right.
They don't even look at it. It's like three pages. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So their whole worldview and perception thinks it's all coming down on
them. Because most people, I think, which is probably more healthy from a mental perspective, that don't go there and think about what's fucked up about them, and certainly they don't talk about them. I think for people like us, you know, and I got to a point, I didn't really talk about, I didn't think of myself, I came to that conclusion sort of as my late teens that I'm just crazy. And I thought, you know something, that's just who I am. And it wasn't, you know, I just realized I really think I'm crazy. And I am crazy, you know. But I think when you realize that, it doesn't necessarily, should not give you a license to be an asshole. But if you just, you at least have to point it out. And I am the first to point out everything that's awful about me. You're the same way, you know what I mean?
And it takes time, though, and you have to hurt people.
Yeah, and the thing is, if I never saw a psychiatrist for the period that I saw a psychiatrist, or go on antidepressants, then, you know, I did that also largely for my wife and my young daughter, because I really don't want to be... But for me, I would say first and foremost for me, I could not continue. I described, you know, when it was that awful moment where I just had all this work on my shoulders and I was panicking, but I'd felt like that in different degrees my entire life, and I realized to my life lived unmedicated, and I didn't self-medicate because I didn't do drugs at all, was...
Why, because you're afraid
painful.
Of them?
It wasn't... Well, a little bit of, like, I did not...
Losing
who
control.
Knows? If someone had given me a drug that made me feel so wonderful, you know, when I was 16 or 17, or if pot did that for me, which it didn't... Maybe, but it's not my personality. You know why? Because I judge others. I'm these fucking people taking drugs. And stuff. I hated kids so much in school, so anything they were doing and stuff, or my brothers were doing, I did not want to be like that. But I also had a sense of, I always felt that I was teetering on some sort of mental disaster or breakdown anyway. I'm like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to start fucking around with drugs and things. There was no concept in my mind that they could help, whether they were recreational drugs or... Of course, back, you know, then they're like, so they're no psychiatrists.
And also, fun in general was completely alien to you.
Yes, that's absolutely true. So, my fun ended, if I had any amount of fun, was the day that I could no longer, that I was put into pre-K, whatever the fuck it is, you know, and I was no longer, you know, in the passenger seat in the station wagon with my mother going to the grocery store, which was that was relaxing. My brothers were in school, it's just me and my mom. And
like for me, like what I've realized is that, like, when people go, like, are you happy? It's like, for me, it's never been about happiness. It's been about relief.
Yeah.
That like relief and happiness are the same to me in a way. I'm learning a little more now about, you know, the idea of happiness, but to me it's terrifying. It really
is. Yeah, and I'm sure, I don't know if you have, like, there's moments of maybe some manic happiness which dissipates very quickly.
Yeah, I get mania for like 2 or 3 days usually.
Yeah,
before
that's pretty long
before I get a cold. Yeah. Or just it just comes and I'm like, all right, this is that thing that yeah. happens for a few days. But I don't get depressed. I get like sometimes I feel like things are pointless.
Yeah, it's do you feel this? This is what I've recently, I mean, not that recently, but I think I in trying to pinpoint what it is. When I am at my most happy, it's when I felt I've done good work. I've written something that's this and that. And if I don't do that, I am fucked up. You know, like the book made me feel good. I had a good sense when I it was the of anything I've done. It was the first time I felt that I had control of it. This was not going to be turned into anything else. I was just writing a book, and it was something that I had to do because yeah. I felt that my writing was not, my name was on shitty movies that I really will say, not my fault. That's the lamest thing a writer can say. So I know people, they listen to this, it's the oldest writer thing. Well, you should have read my script. In my case, The Cabin Boy's a whole other story. I don't know the strength to get into that right now anyway. But anyway,
maybe
it's just
in 10 minutes.
But it may be. Okay. But but then there's other stuff I've done. And I also realized that the medium of television and film, you know, you're not going to, in writing this book, is this the only thing that's going to be pure that you really are?
Right,
the,
because in radio,
the tour that you don't, yeah, yeah.
In radio and film, you're basically like, you're doing a job, yeah. you're on a staff, your work is your own only to the degree till it goes to the next guy.
Yeah.
And then they decide whether they're even going to use it or not, and if they're going to change it or not. Or and then like the problem with, you know, the wonderful union protection, which is good, is like, hey, don't worry about it. It's shit now, but you get the credit.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I know. Lovely. It just doesn't.
What do you care? You got the credit.
Yeah. It's like, I know that's everything. I would rather be fucking poor and be able to hold my head up a little bit. A fucking credit. You'd have the credit.
So, where, how do you get into the first job as Letterman?
Yeah.
How does that happen? Did you go to college?
I went briefly. I went to, you know, my grades were so bad coming out of high school. I had no intention of going to college.
Me either.
Because school to me was, I mean, it's a lame cliche or comparison, but it really was prison to me, without a doubt. It's the closest thing I could compare it to. And when I got out, it was like, I'm not going back to any of those situations. So I worked when I was 16. Well, first I was like, I worked for a landscaper, a guy who later got brutally murdered. Which is another thing. That's the other thing. When you think that everything bad is going to happen and then bad things do happen, it confirms. I remember, you know, certain sure. things in my childhood that made me real. When I was young and my dog was killed and hit by a car and killed, I'm fucked up about that to this day. But it also reinforced my natural biological, you know, mentally way of processing things that bad things are always going to happen. My parents are going to die. I never this is the interesting thing. I'm not a hypochondriac at all. Yeah. I don't have patience for that. I know a little bit. Most people are. I my thing is losing people around me that I care about. I hope I live a long time and I hope I'm healthy, you know, but it's not like if I went to a doctor and he said, this is probably nothing, but there's a lump here, you know, I would instantly be like, oh fuck, you know,
yeah.
But I don't think about it. I'm not always like touching myself and feeling yeah. for, I don't, if I get, you know, I don't have that. I worry about other people. Even death is not something that I obsess over.
For
just
yourself.
The people who are written, not for myself.
Isn't that interesting?
I don't have that. Yeah, yeah.
You got a fear of people leaving for good.
Yeah, it started with my, you know, my parents, my mother specifically. I always thought growing up every year this is the year something's going to happen. She's going to die.
Is she alive?
Yeah, she is. And so I'm very, you know, I'm lucky. That's a funny thing. It turned out to be whatever. And so I...
Wrong.
Wrong. Exactly. But yet some things turned out to be true. The dog one was a big one for
right,
me.
Yeah, but that's sort of like, after a certain point, you realize this is my belief system. Like, you know, this is how my brain works. Yeah. And even if it's crazy, it's yeah. how... It's how I comfort myself, or it's how I define myself. Even if the panic about other people, that somehow the repetition of that pattern, you know, keeps you in a place. Even if it's not a good place, it's something that's familiar to you.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, there's obviously ways to maybe get out of that place, or sort of make it less menacing. But it's the way that, like, I'm learning that these negative patterns mm-hmm. are really what we call home. It's what we've done.
Yeah.
It's what we come from.
Right.
So you just repeat them. And to change them, like I just learned yesterday, someone talked to me about neural pathways. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah.
But it's work.
You can't. I don't think they're you can help. I think when I was seeing a psychiatrist, and antidepressants maybe have helped maybe 13%. I'll take that.
But you know, maybe a little bit. But you've decided you can live with it, obviously.
I think I can live with it, and I think I am I've realized that, you know, I think you are what you are. You can't, you can change a little bit. Everyone can change a little bit, but I can't, you know, whatever.
Here's what I believe. It's your, you know. Here's what I believe. And it's like, it's a little bit kind of sappy. I think what you can change is, and it usually will happen anyways, with age, as you get humbled and your pride diminishes.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, you can open your heart more and become a more giving person, even in the context of all your problems.
I agree with that. Absolutely.
And that's a pretty tremendous change.
Yeah, that is absolutely. Yep. And it's,
when you had a kid, you were, whoa.
No, here's the thing is, it did become that. It became that. I mentioned it in the book, you know, the pregnancy worried me because I did not want a boy because of my brother, the brother experience. I don't like boys in general. Yeah. I'm telling you, the first day of kindergarten, it was, and I always love women. Yeah. I always had also, by the way, early sexual, strong heterosexual feel. I don't know if you had that. I can remember being very young. Like,
oh, yeah, I remember
my brother having Playboys and stuff, not knowing what sex is, not knowing anything, but seeing, you know, and being like, but in general, though, I always thought that girls and women are kinder, they're less nuts, they're just, now of course we know that's not a blanket thing, but I found that better. So right away at kindergarten, when I walked in and saw
also
these,
all the men in your life were crazy.
Yes, yes.
And mean, abusive, fucking volatile people.
But I don't know about you, I didn't have this thing where like when I saw the kids in school when I first got there, the little other little kids, and the boys, just them all with their fucking trucks and their toy guns and their G.I. Joes, I never liked that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and the girls were sweeter. They were nice. So I associate women with safety and intelligence and something that's more just, they're just emotionally smarter. I know it's a blanket thing, and there's plenty of whack jobs out there. You know, both sexes, but still, I just
And when you're a guy that doesn't like that, see, what I gravitated towards was older, like, and we grew up roughly in the same time. But you had brothers, so it was all in the house: the records, the hair, the cigarettes, pot. Yeah. But I didn't have that, so because I didn't like trucks and stuff, I immediately gravitated towards like the pictures of the hippies, and you know, like that to me was like great. Like, I didn't like trucks, but I wanted to grow my hair out.
Oh, yeah, I did that because my brother drew that too. That was, that absolutely. No, that was cool to me. That stuff. And although I also liked really, like I said, from a young age, really like this, you know, 1920s music. You know,
someone put that in you somehow.
Yeah, I know. I don't like. I think, and I described in the book, it's true. There's something that matched it. It was comforting when they would show these old cartoons from the 30s on TV. That the background music was something that really worked for me, and then you start hearing that kind of, and then it took me, you know, many years I would hear that again and say, oh, that's that kind of sound of the music I like. And then in my teens, I started to get very, you know, learning a lot about it.
78 and stuff. So how do you get this fucking job? You don't
finish
college.
I had no interest in it. I just want to say, like, growing up, I had no aspirations to do anything. I just assumed I'd sell insurance. But I did start. I was smart in the sense of, like, I really liked movies, like a lot of old movies on television. Then by, you know, the early 80s, really influenced by all those great movies from the 70s. And that's when the first buzz of people started talking about going to film school.
Yeah.
And I had to get out of Harrisburg at that point. Mm-hmm. So, but in order to go to NYU, I had to go to Harrisburg Area Community College in 2 years to get my grades up because I could not even get into a shithole.
I did the same thing. I fucked off in high school. And my senior year, I panicked because I wanted to leave. And I applied myself and got like, you know, A- average.
That's how I was at community college. I was, there suddenly I was a smarty because I applied myself and I had a goal, you know?
Get
I
didn't
give a fuck about, you know, I never once thought at any point in school up to and including my senior year about going to college or being anything.
Yeah.
Never even, I was just like, how do I get out
I
of the house?
I wanted to be an artist.
How do I fucking survive? See, that's good. See, that's,
of some kind.
I just had, there was no one in Harrisburg that would even make that thing seem, you just never heard about anyone like,
right.
And I'm a person, another one of my big problems is I perceive everything to be impossible, so what's the point of even trying,
right?
I'll come out every different way that couldn't happen.
Impossible. So
we'd be living in caves if I was like the head caveman.
That's the anxiety thing. It's sort of like, but then you got to go to the place, and then what, you got to hire people,
yeah,
and then you
got, yeah, so, yeah. Yeah, right, yeah. It's just like, yeah, it never happened. Yeah, it's never happened. Yeah, it's like,
well, that's the difference between someone like us and like Judd Apatow.
Yeah, exactly. No, right. Yeah, someone like that who, you know, knew early what he wanted to do, was focused on that,
and can maintain
kind of
the businesses.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how does he even go out? I mean, I see him doing comedy again, and I'm like, you know, don't. What about the empire?
Yeah, right.
Don't you have a family?
Yeah.
You know, like, how do you? What happens is they trust people. They deliberate power. They outsource jobs, and they, you know, they're respected as a boss. They hold the leadership thing.
It's interesting. Even if I was capable of achieving something like that, I would not. The big part of me just could not handle. They could not push for that. I wouldn't want to be that out there and that part of every. I don't know what it is. I wouldn't be comfortable. I don't want to be part of a scene. That's the thing, and that's why I never the and or part of the which I know is interesting because comedians, you stand up. Yeah. That's a really big thing.
But we're all the same. All comedians are like you and me. A lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, I have a few friends. Yeah, I guess.
The great thing about comedians is there's a shorthand to it, and it's good to be around brilliant, funny people. It makes you feel better.
Well, that's what made when I finally moved to New York and started, and then.
So you got out of community college.
So I go to film school in New York, and right away that sucks, and I'm already thinking. My only goal at that point is how do I stay in the city? Because New York City fit me like a glove. It was the first. That was actually the first time I was truly happy.
Yeah.
Because you know why? You can get lost. You can be alone. You can eat by yourself.
Right.
You know. And so, anyway, I didn't even know what an internship was. Some kid was telling me he got an internship for a producer reading scripts, and I was already worried. Like, what am I going to do when I graduate? Like, I'm not going to be able to afford to stay here. My family can't afford to keep. What, you know? This is all. Am I going to go back to Harrisburg? And so that made me think. When he said, I was like, oh, an internship. I never heard that word before, which I had not.
Yeah.
And so what I was interested in, I was never like this comedy geek. I liked smart comedy. I knew it when it like SCTV or this and that, and I liked that kind of stuff, but it wasn't any particular obsession with mine. I liked, you know, a lot of old movies and stuff like that. So I was more into Scorsese than anything.
Yeah, sure.
But what I was really into at that time was the Letterman show, which had been on for about 2 years. And I was obsessed with that show.
First couple of years were insanely great.
But I was more obsessed with Dave.
Yeah.
Dave was, I could just tell that this guy was one of the, it was the first guy that I think, we think sort of alike the way he, not necessarily comedian, he's a brilliant comedian and everything.
Right.
I mean, the way he's looking at things and his hatred for bullshit and phoniness and the way people are. He was the first guy to really, you know, sort of shit on show business and celebrities.
And he was like, when those first couple of years, I mean, he pushed it.
He pushed it. And that really, you know, struck a chord with me in a way that, you know, Woody Allen, a little bit, I saw, it's interesting. I recognize some of that neurosis. But like, he was, you know, again, the hypochondria and all that kind of Jewy
had no
of,
real
that,
edge
that
to
was
it.
Not that. And then Albert Brooks, I thought, now that's even closer. That's like something that's more because Albert Brooks, some of that, but without the he did it without the Jewish thing,
right.
Like Woody Allen did. So I was like, but Letterman, that was something that was like, oh my god. And so I was, you know, I just thought this guy is the great. So so now I know about these things called internships. I went back to my dorm room. I cold called the Letterman show and said, do you have any of these things called internships? And they said, we have we just lost our writer's intern. Can you come up and just, you know, meet someone for an interview? And I was like, yeah. I went straight up there. I met Steve O'Donnell. Great intern. Is a great guy.
He's there forever.
He's the mind. During when the show was really up and running at its greatest, he as the head writer is so responsible for the great, you know, like a lot of people. Obviously, Merrill created everything, but Steve, unbelievable. So Steve liked me, and then he said, we'll come back, and I met some to meet, have a couple other meetings, and then I got it. And I said to myself,
Dave?
No, I didn't meet Dave. That's a funny story. I didn't meet Dave till probably about a few weeks into my internship, maybe even less. Then it was a very small office. You always saw Dave. You know, it wasn't like, and it was a, you know, wasn't that he wasn't the CBS Dave. It was still, but he was still, the show was, you know, he was like,
I know that
Rolling
studio,
Stone and stuff.
On NBC.
Yeah. So I guess as soon as I got that internship was the first time I ever had a goal for anything. And I said, I knew that place was right for me. I knew I could write for that. I knew the sensibility, but I knew, you know, it wasn't going to be easy. But I said to myself, I don't care if it takes 10 fucking years because I have no other way to enjoy my life or to do something that I think I could do and make a living at. This is it. And I was said to myself, I want to be a writer here. And I was I was good as the writer's assistant. I was really helpful. Steve liked me. Chris Elliott took me under his wing as well. But those guys really encouraged me, told me, you should at that time, Chris became a writer and maybe one or two other people, they were submitting jokes to Dave's assistant. He wouldn't use them, but back then he would look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I started, so on Chris's advice, I started giving like 5 jokes a day to Dave's assistant. And then, I don't know when it was, maybe a couple months later, I can remember that she said, hey, do you got a minute for Dave, Adam? I'm opening up viewer mail. I edited the viewer mail,
right.
That segment. And I couldn't believe that. I went in and he's like, hey, and he has they're in blue paper. You're supposed to have that blue sheet. I like these jokes. It's really good. Just keep doing it. Keep doing it. And I walked out of there and it was like, the single greatest feeling I ever had in my life. And I knew at that point, yeah, and I kept writing them. And he, for some reason, really took a shine to my jokes, which were not like topical. They were weird stuff and they didn't really get laughs, but it was more like, I think it was very much Pennsylvania, so Indiana, Midwestern type of kind of thing. And he liked that kind of weird stuff. So he always got a kick out of the jokes. The audience never did. And eventually I was hired. And so had I not made that, this is why we know that, luck plays so much. When people ask you, how do you do it? It's like there's no real – first of all, you have to be able – whatever you're going to do, whether it's stand-up, an actor, the thing it starts with is you either have it or you don't. You know what I mean? You got to be able to do it. And then it's just about luck because you just may never have that conversion, that intersection that I was like. If I had made that call
the next day,
they pray that they would have been filled. I think about it all the time. It's not, it's not like you would have ended up doing something. No, because I wouldn't have pursued it. I'm not. That was the one time I had the eye of the tiger when I made that call and when I worked my ass off of that show as an intern, and later it was a writer's.
So what was the first meeting with Dave before the he liked your jokes?
Oh, that was where I was opening. I was in this. It was in the conference room. It was a little conference room then. This is before they expanded the offices and. So I was at this sort of table and I had my little my letter opener and just slicing open these
the
viewer mail. I had a box of mail and making a pile that I copy for the writers, and from those they would write things for the viewer mail segment. And
did you decide what was good or bad, or you just opened them?
No, I added them. And that was also too, Steve O'Donnell was like, I remember the first time he looked at my folder of the ones that he goes, this is, one of the best batch we've had in a long time. Because you have to sort of figure out, oh, this is a good, this one is good.
It's something's funny.
Good. Yeah. But there's some that, you can't, you don't want to overwhelm them with too much. And so I got the show. I mean, I knew the show before I even got there. And, but anyway, so I'm sort of catty corner from Dave's office. There was his assistant's office, and then there was another door that led into Dave's office. But every time Dave came out into the hallway, he had to make eye contact with me if I looked up, and so he did that a few times. And then I was always thinking, what's it gonna be like the first time I meet Dave? Just don't make an asshole out of yourself. And he came in finally and goes, yeah, I don't think we've met. I'm Dave. And, I said, I'm Adam. And then I said it for no 5 seconds. So I said, I'm Adam, a promising young intern. And he said, and after I said, I was like, what the fuck? Why don't you just shut the fuck? And he, so I said, yeah, hi, I'm Adam. I'm a promising young intern. And he said, yeah, I'm sure you are. And then he turned off. But he was, I got to say, very quickly, it was like a small staff. It was like a family. And, he got to know me and he liked, he kind of liked my sense of humor, just the way I talked. I was never, ever trying to be a funny guy, and I wasn't a joke yet. I think he saw me for who I was. What I mean? I think that this is sort of cynical, beaten down, but that's what I was. And he has some of that. And there's a lot to Dave. I think we're similar in certain ways, not in the part where I have this amazing genius talent that I become, but we have a similar sense of humor, a similar way of looking at things. And I think there was a little bit of a slight bonding over that.
And you were there for 7 years, 8 years?
5, 6 years, yeah.
And did the relationship grow at all?
It did, actually. It was, and to this day, he's, and Chris Elliott will tell you the same thing, I think, some other people, but for me, Dave is, I gotta say, probably the most important person, people in my life. He's just he's like my older brother or father kind of thing. When I wrote the book, when I write anything, when I wrote the book, everything I wrote was thinking, you know, this has got to be. It pushed me. If Dave doesn't like this, I'm fucked. I wrote it for Dave. I wrote. He was the. If everyone hated it except for Dave, I would have been okay with that. And when I heard that he told me too. He called me and he loved the book. That was this book. It's interesting. Did take a certain amount of weight off my shoulders that I think will stay off.
Mm-hmm.
Not completely, you know, because, you know, you get used to it. But it's like, I think I did something that I feel good about. I don't say it's perfect, you know. I think I'll do better even, the next time. But, I feel good about the book. The fact that Dave was so nice about it, had me on the show, that was a big thing for me. Because before that, I had, because of this, you know, the way the business is, I just felt like, you know, if anyone just saw, well, what did this guy do? I didn't feel there was anything I could really be proud of, and and some things that I was very embarrassed about. And I was also upset about the whole thing about things money jobs you got to do for money and not for me to be rich, but just to live a middle-class life in New York City, which takes a lot of money. And, mm-hmm. You know, my daughter's in private school, so it's still, you know, so, but... It's so, you know, I was full of shame for so many years since Cabin Boy. Then I had
supernatural bad luck
with a couple of other movies.
You left Dave to work with Chris on Get a Life.
Yeah.
And people love that show.
Yeah, no, I'm happy about that.
And then you did a lot of episodes. I mean, you had what, 3 seasons?
No, a season and a half.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So it didn't take, but you were proud of that.
Yes and no. Chris and I did not have a good experience working on that show.
Together or above you?
I mean, Chris and I were like together. We were in the foxhole together. Right. But it was there was some. It was an awful experience. And also then, coming from Dave, which was such a great experience, you know.
And you left to pursue this. You know, you thought it was time.
Here's what happened. This is where everyone's life is different, and no one. What happened to me? I don't know if anyone has things like that. Of course, people do things that turn out badly.
Right.
No, so Chris said to me, "There's a, you know, Fox wants to do a show with me. Do you wanna write it with me?" And I said, "I'm at Letterman." I was like, "Yeah, sure." I didn't think anything would happen. I never was thinking I wanted to do sitcoms. This is a time when a lot of writers were leaving to go to Fox, and I had no interest in that. So, you know, Chris and I said we wrote the show, and then I didn't think anything would happen. Then suddenly they want to make the pilot. Now I'm getting a little nervous because, like, I don't know what I want to do. I like it. I love working with Chris. The pilot was a total. Sort of, it was a bait and switch a bit for the, it was nothing that I think Chris and I were very proud of, mm-hmm. you know, because it was very, we wanted, you know, to get picked up. Chris wanted it to get picked up, obviously, clearly, it was a big thing for him. And so it was a little compromise, the pilot, it gives me douche chills, the pilot, I can't look at that. But it's so here's the thing is, so just unnaturally, I don't know how long I would have stayed at Dave. Not my whole, I mean, I definitely wanted to do other things. I wanted to write, I wanted to write features.
Mm-hmm.
But so I was sort of fell into that, which is what it was. And then when we're at Get a Life, then suddenly Chris gets a call from Tim Burton, and then that turns into us doing Cabin Boy. So all these things just sort of happened to me. There were nothing that I planned for, was trying to do, and Cabin Boy destroyed my life and destroyed my mind, made me even a more weaker, worried human.
How?
Being.
Why? What happened?
The fallout, the embarrassment, and that I was...
Oh, how's Tim? So Tim Burton, you guys had the script. Whose script was it?
Tim wanted to do like a Pee-wee's Big Adventure thing again, because he was doing the big movies, and so he thought he wanted one with Chris.
Chris,
you know?
Yeah.
So we was, you know, Chris, and for Chris's stuff, he's the only guy I ever wrote with, and it was always just for Chris material.
Right.
I never had a writing partner for my own stuff. But so... you know, Chris had this idea to maybe do a version of Captain's Courageous with Chris playing like the Freddie Bartholomew character, this like snobby rich kid that ends up on a fishing boat, you know, with these, you know, hard-nosed seamen. So it seemed like a natural.
Yeah.
And then Tim was going to direct it, and I thought, well, you know, this will be good for me. I have my name on a script that Tim Burton's going to direct, and, you know, he directs stuff that this will make it easier for me, even though I don't want to do... necessarily big Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
I want to do cool movies.
Yeah.
That was my thing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, whether I could pull it off or not, I don't know. But when Tim dropped out, they said, Adam, you should direct it. And I was like, well, I've never really, you know, I directed and did things on little segments and shit, you know. But they all convince you and your agent, no, you'll have help with that. But the main thing is, this is the big lesson. One, never do anything just for the opportunity. The reason I eventually gave in, because like the agent said, you know, if you do this, do you know how easy it's going to be for you? And I was like, well, I wanted to do movies. But
you'll be in the guild.
But this is right. Yeah, right. And but this is something, if I was going to write a movie by myself, or if I was going to write one with Chris, for Chris, Chris and I in a million years would never have fucking come up with Cabin Boy.
Right.
This was something that was designed for Tim, that Tim helped, you know, he shepherded it. He loved the idea. It was like Captain's Courageous meets Ray Harryhausen. Yeah. We told him it was meant for his sensibility. So then when I was finally convinced to direct it, you know, I hated, right off the bat, I hated the experience of directing. At least that I didn't like. And it was not something that I would have done on my own. I felt very odd.
It must have been insane on the set with you trying to...
It was, I mean, it wasn't fun. And also, it's not my personality to be actually in a collaborative situation. I don't like being around a lot of people. I don't want to have meetings.
Yeah.
I know what these things, well, what should the scale of the ice monster be? I didn't, and plus, I had no, here's the big thing, no passion for that project. I just wanted to get through it, and I assumed it'll probably do okay. I'm a little concerned that it wasn't him, but the fallout, which I don't know if you remember, was so, this is the worst thing. I'm a snob, as I'm sure you are, about anything, about movies, literature.
I try to be a little broader lately, a little more diplomatic.
I do, but I like what I like.
Sure,
and
sure.
It doesn't mean that, you know, I can't like something silly, but whatever.
Right.
So to be this movie when it came out, Cabin Boy, which was not good. I look at it now and go, you know, it's kind of this odd little thing. It doesn't bother me. But at the time, it was seen as like beneath Pauly Shore movie. So I didn't even know what it was. I had no opinion about it at that point. All I know is that it tested off. You know, it was awful. So I now, not only was I worried about money, because I no one, partially was, yeah, it was going to be hard to get
so
any
it was
kind
a
of
joke.
Job.
It was a joke,
and I was now, I felt, and for a number of years too, that I was perceived as a hack. And I'm thinking, you know something? It's not like I have a big ego, but I'm not a fucking hack. I'm a snob, and I'm actually a pretty good writer who now cannot get a job because of that. And it's seen, and I am seen as someone that wrote the hackiest, shittiest, worst, the Pauly Shore, it might as well be an Orson Welles movie compared to Cabin Boy. Cabin Boy for a while was like the word for a shitty movie. It would be compared to, I would see it in articles. I remember there was some article, you could not escape. That's the thing that people don't remember. Now Chris and I, we go, there'll be screenings, you know, and we'll do Q&A sometimes. And there's a following, not gigantic, but enough that there's people that really like it, okay? And they don't like it because I've asked them in these things. I said, do you guys like it because it's one of those, it's so bad, it's good things?
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some people that like it for that reason. There's people that do see it as something that they just kind of like as this weird comedy. But
so it was the brunt of all jokes.
It was the brunt of all jokes. I was literally... For a while, like, it embarrassed me to walk out of the house. This is in the immediate aftermath. It got a lot of press. This is before the internet days. Hard, real press of people. And I'll go to my grave and say, well, Chris, I don't know where. It's not that people didn't like the movie, critics and things. It pissed them off. And there was anger, and it was on every Cabin Boy. You could not escape some mention of Cabin Boy. I remember there was an article, and I think it was the LA Times, the New York Times, about the Laserdisc craze. And the article was about all these directors. And I'm reading it, and I'm thinking, oh, this is an interesting article about Laserdisc. They're talking about all these director cuts. You know, now Aliens 2, James Cameron is adding extra footage. Is this really the idea of a director's cut? It was questioning whether that's a good idea. The movie should be the movie. And I'm reading it, enjoying it, minding my own business. The last line is, yep, so what's in store for us in the future? A director's cut of Cabin Boy? And I'm like, Jesus, I can't. Everywhere I turned, there was shit like that. You could not escape it. They would not give me a break, or Chris. And so it was the most creative paralysis and depression that I had had. By the way, this is still pre-psychiatrist, pre-antidepressants for me. So just raw. I don't drink. I don't do drugs. I don't even take.
And the world is crushing you.
The world
you,
is
you
crushing
walk out
me.
With you. You're wearing glasses to protect yourself from this thing that you probably isn't. It was bad, but I'm sure there weren't people out in front of your house.
This is how crazy I was. I literally used to think as I was embarrassed just to get from my apartment down to the lobby. I can sort of remember. I thought like maybe a woman starting to come out of the door, neighbor, and see me, and quickly stepping back in and shut the door. I'd walk down Columbus
like
Avenue.
Peter Lorre in that movie.
That was me. I might as well have done something like you know like that. But he's and when I was walking down Columbus, I would actually think sometimes that, and I'm not crazy this way. This is the depth of my crazy. I'm not this kind of crazy. I actually think that, you know, I thought people might avert their glance, you know, if they would look at me thinking, oh, that's the guy that did that fucking cabin boy.
And like, if you just looked at the numbers of people that actually saw the movie, the ratio would not ever add up.
Yeah. And so right. But it was written about.
No,
a
I get
lot.
It. I get
it was
it.
For what a period of time, instead of saying Heaven's Gate, they would say cabin boy, which made no sense because this is a cheap little movie. It was when Disney was cranking out a shitty live action movies like, you know, Hocus Pocus or The Air Up There or Captain Ron. No offense to those movies. I haven't seen any of them. But Captain Boy is just another shitty live action that Touchstone was doing.
I think the real horrible sort of the worst part about it is that in your mind, this was like a sentence worse than death. Something outside of your control had realized your greatest fears. So what
is so smart? That's right.
And what was happening is, you know, whether the people outside of the world were doing whatever they were doing, the audience in your head that was judging you, the room full of little yous was like, oh, now you've done it. No, it's fucking over.
It's over. And also, it's sometimes with the brother or two that I may be talking at a time, I remember, you know, coming up with this phrase of which then they will occasionally refer to it. I'll say the Resnick curse. I've always thought about a Resnick curse. This is before, when I saw that Coen Brothers movie that starts A Serious Man, and it starts out
so
like at a shuttle or whatever, and there's that that Dybbuk or whatever at the beginning that I guess implying that it, that, you know, sort of maybe cursed the generation of that family. Even I would, before I had any sense of, you know, of that, thinking of it that way, I just thought there was some kind of and so the Resnick curse had finally, you know, the chickens
manifest
come home
itself.
To roost.
Yeah.
And it was, and here's where the fucked up thing with someone like my
centuries old.
I can imagine so many bad things that are not reality. My wife, if she has said one thing to me, one phrase the most over all the years we've been together, it's this: why would you think like that?
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, it's always that. And but the thing is, here's where that, and sometimes I can think, you know, maybe it is my brain that's thinking I'm out of the business, I'm this or that. But what happens when, in the case of Cabin Boy, it was really, this is not my imagination. No one did want to hear from me for a while. I remember, and I just, this comes back to you asked me when my child was born. My daughter, and I didn't want a boy, I was so happy it was a girl, was born about a month before Cabin Boy came out, and I already knew what was going to happen. I didn't actually know it would be as bad as it was, but I knew that the movie was a bomb, and I knew from the testing, and I knew that I would not get work again easily, but now I had a daughter to support. So when my daughter was born, I remember being in there, my first reaction to seeing her was just utter fear, because I realized I have this new responsibility that I've never, you know, and I don't know what. Now, it's interesting. You fantasize and you think, well, so what's the worst going to happen? You're never going to be homeless. You'll move to Harrisburg or a town like Harrisburg, and you'll rent a little apartment.
That's
and at least
horrifying.
You won't be homeless.
Well,
that's what my safety net was. You know what I mean?
But in your mind, right. In your mind, though, that safety net, and I did that too when everything went off the skids for me, is that plan B or that safety net, it's vague and it's, you know, at its root, horrendous.
Yes, it is horrendous. Yes, and it actually doesn't give you much comfort.
No,
it only makes you realize that your worst thing is like I have to live in a homeless shelter with my family. But I think, okay, well at least I know I can take that off the table. But you know that makes you feel good for about a second. Then you realize,
what's the job?
Right.
You know, like it's like okay, I come from a certain like I've done enough things. But But my problem was like. At 45, 50, like, I'll just stop and I'll get a job doing what?
Right. No, that's the thing is, that's what occasionally you do feel lucky, and I realize I make a living doing literally the only thing I can do. That's all I can do.
Then what happened? You did SNL for a while?
No, that was one, this is in the dark years after Cabin Boy. Chris went to SNL for probably what must have been one of the worst seasons ever.
Yeah.
And it was, I didn't want to work there. I was still embarrassed about Cabin Boy. I didn't even want to be seen. This is, I think, about a year after. But Chris, somehow, I went up and met your buddy, Lorne. Mm. And I needed to make a little money, but I knew I did not want to work there. And I'm thinking the whole thing about, oh, they write overnight? Yeah, I don't think so. I'm not going to fucking, you know. Not that the show was not good that season. The cast was really big. The guys like Farley and Sandler were on the way out the door. They were on weekends going to shoot movies and then coming back. And it was a very depressing vibe up there.
Yeah, he was trying to put together the following season is when I auditioned, I think.
Yeah, and he was, you know, Lorne, to his credit, I mean, there was like Don Olmeyer and Littlefield. They had him out the door. I mean, they were, and it was... you never would have thought at that time that Lorne would survive. And it's amazing. He did. Not only he survived, look where he is now. That said, I never, it was not in me to, I never, like I said, I never wanted to be in the business anyway. So I never chased anything for big money. I've always been, to me, it was always about the work. You know, although sometimes you have to. I mean, especially this post-Cabin Boy years, I was taking money jobs because I had to do it.
I don't think there's any shame in that. I've done that.
It happens, and you just...
Hope it doesn't work out, in a way.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, so, yeah, right. Especially back then. I mean, the first job I got, by the way, was writing a script, a guy about a guy that turns into a dog, and he said, yeah, and there's scenes where he's drinking out of the toilet. That's the type of job I had
what
to
was
take.
That?
It was, I forget the name of it. And by the way, the guy who gave me the job, I'm the producer, God bless him, because, you know, it was in that year after Cabin Boy, we're seeing like nothing.
Didn't you write
no one
Death
wanted
the Smoochie?
To talk to me. Yeah, that was, so that's one of the, again, the scripts that, you know, that, and there's one I did called Numbers that Nora Ephron, they ended up, I mean, those movies did not come out the way that I pictured it. That the writer is not is king in television, but unless you're a writer director, you have to expect this. And when I sold those scripts, they were good sales. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You give it, you got to know you're losing control.
But you're okay with that now in a way.
That
you
movie
can handle it. No, but doing it that way, knowing that this is that.
No, I don't think I'll do it that way. Here's all I want. I want to make a comfortable living. And the thing is, I'm living in New York City, though, so that's not like, you know, you got to bring in some money. A comfortable living, doing what I want with some little sidesteps into some money jobs or things like that that, you know, might be enjoyable to work on or something. But mostly it all comes back to subsidizing myself to if I'm going to write another book or if maybe I'm going to write a screenplay, a small movie, and I'm talking to a producer that I like, that there might be a shot there. I might give that one more chance, the movie thing, because I love movies, but it's harder than ever now when you think about getting something really cool. It's got to be a small movie.
But you're okay?
And what say I'm great? I don't know. I'm great. No, Mark, I'm like I'm $1 million. I just everything's perfect now. You mean okay? What?
You're making a living.
Oh yeah, no. I'm fine. I'm that way, but not no. But it's always a I don't need a lot. Never did. But then there's other things you think. Oh wow, wouldn't it be nice to have a house at the beach? That's another thing. But part of me is like, you know, how many other people own more than one fucking house? I have a really good...
I think that too, and it's a fantasy I have, but it's like, who's gonna take care of it when I'm not there? And like, where is there going to be... Like, is there going to be problems with the house? And
that's
like,
what happened to me.
What if I don't go there?
I had
much?
A country house that like sort of imploded. They tell you, like, you know, you realize you have the money for the house and everything. What they don't tell you, and, you know, I remember checking out, so I'm going to get this country house, my accountant. Yeah, no, you can do it. That's fine. Sure. But then you don't. It's about upkeep. You can't walk away from that. Hey,
some people just don't give a shit. Like, you know, people like us are just designed to self generate and manage what we can manage. And because then if you hire people, then you're like, who's that guy? How's he gonna fuck me? I don't know, man.
Well, I also like. I mean, you're probably the same way. I mean, I turned down the money and jobs that I've turned down over the years far exceeds. You know, like I. There's so many ways I could have made money. There's so many ways that things that I just couldn't do. In fact, when Get a Life, I hated living out here because I, you know, after being at Letterman, after Get a Life was over, I was like, that's it for me in LA. Even though later I did like a stint at Larry Sanders and there were some other jobs I lived in.
How was that?
Never thought of, well, I'll tell you that in a second. But anyway, but but I never, you know, when I moved back to New York, I knew that was a choice. My agent said, you know, you're going to cut your options down. I said, and it was like, well, that's the trade off because I have to live in New York. And so, it's about, you know, like, so I still turn down shit it's whatever. It's about it's about the work. It's always been, but I don't want to be poor. And if anyone wants to give me a shitload of money for something that I'll be happy to take it.
Larry Sanders is a very, very well respected show. That must have made up a little bit for Cabin Boy.
Well, that was like everyone else. I love that show. That's one of the greatest shows ever.
So you came in after it was rolling.
It was rolling. It was the final season, and it was. And I was happy to do it.
Do you love Gary?
I would have preferred to stay a fan of the show rather than work. You know, I didn't never, you know, I actually, I think Gary and I are so, you know, Dave to me is the guy that it was so, it so clicked, you know, our relationship.
Right,
Gary's
a
completely different sort of guy.
Right.
So there was not that, I did not have a similar feeling. He's a very different guy than Dave is.
Right.
And it's his show. and he has a way of running it, and it was not, you know, I had some fun there, but for the most part, it was the right, you know, the fact that it was just whatever, we did 10 or 11 episodes, that was, that felt right to me. I had my fill, it was the end of the season, but it was, yeah, whatever, what can I tell you? I've had better times other places, but it was, in retrospect, I guess it wasn't so bad. You can't, you know, you can't, if you're not, if you feel like you can't really contribute at the level that you think you're capable of, it's not fun. And if some, if a place makes it a little difficult to do that, and, you know, Gary is the, you know, he's the guy. It's his show. He's been doing it. And so, it was, I'd heard this, I knew, I had other friends who had worked there over the years, you know, so I sort of knew what I was getting into, but I'd met Gary a couple times. I thought, I know what Gary is. He's another guy. I mean, he's not like me, but there's some, you know, some fucked up things about both of us that I'm sure I could. And I felt like it for a while, like, you know, there was a point that, you know, I was getting along with him pretty good, and it was, but then the guy, once we got into the thick of things, then everything changed, and it felt like, you know, it was, you know, we were in battle, and the battle was going very badly. You know?
Oh yeah,
and it was, and I think it was. I don't know, maybe that's Gary's process. I think he, you know, maybe things have to be made to be a little harder than they're hard enough as it is, but even harder for. That's just his process, the way it works, you know. And it was, you know, there's some, the way to thrive at a show like that, I think, is to be like a creative consultant, where you're just coming in maybe one or two days a week, and you're not part of the actual
right
militia.
Yeah,
that's the tough part, you know.
So what are you working on now?
Right now I'm gonna write another book. There is a
memoir,
a script I want to, no, I think I'm done with that. I might write some one-offs, you know,
sure,
for magazines or something. I
love the book.
Oh, real tell you, that's nice. I really, are you serious? Because that, you know, if someone like you likes that, makes me
love
feel
it.
Great.
Love it.
What else?
Like,
are you gonna
like
say?
They're, and the laughs are surprising. Not in the way that, like, I'm surprised that you make me laugh, but I'm surprised at what I'm laughing at. Like, you know, there are things that are really funny, and I'll laugh at those. But like, for some reason, there are weird beats in the book that just killed me. That, and I don't know that you would, I don't know that you would look at them and go like, that was the hilarious part, but there's just something about your timing. You know, I guess I relate to it so much, the strand bag bit. Like, I have things like that. They're usually like shoes. I just like, I get it.
I'm not, and I don't think it's like a, you know, an OCD thing. I am someone who very much likes a few things that I'm not apt
but
to
that's
change.
What, but that's,
I dress the same way that I've dressed since
me too,
like sixth
but,
grade.
But that's like what magical objects are. You invest them with, you know, they have something important in maintaining the continuity of your life.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And all, and what you said, it's true. You can change, and absolutely the thing about, try to be a nicer person, try to help people more. That's what you can do. But fundamentally, I know at this stage of the game that, you know, the things that are wrong with me, and it is a mental illness, cannot be, they could, it can be helped a little bit, you know, but it can't, you can't really change who you are.
Well, yeah.
My thing is, I've never been, I think for the most part, you know, I'm a pretty decent person when it comes to other people, although I can get pissed off. I hate when people fuck things up. I hate incompetence, and I hate people who are just wrong or bad people, especially, I don't know if you ever had anyone like I, there's a couple people in my life of genuine narcissists, you know what I mean? Narcissist, almost borderline, or possibly a sociopath, that finally, you know, that all gets blurred. Those people are the worst, you know what I mean?
Especially but when they're successful.
Yeah, but you know, the good thing about me is anyone that I know who's a narcissist, especially if it was
a real narcissist.
Yeah. I don't know about you when it comes to jealousy. We're all jealous, you know, about jealousy, especially when it comes to, of course, look, when you go with the stand-up, what the fuck are we talking about? But here's how I am about other writers or anything like who I might know who might be doing better. I honestly am never jealous of success or money. I am only jealous of the quality of the work. And thankfully, the couple of people that I might have a problem with that maybe have done well or this and that, I have no respect for their work. I don't think their work is good. So therefore, I don't have jealousy. If they did some amazing work, that is my thing. I don't give a shit how rich or
so you're actually jealous for creative reasons.
The creative, that's all that's ever mattered to me.
But then are you able to enjoy it? Like, you know, if they do amazing work and you're jealous of it, are you?
No, I'm not that guy. You mean if someone that did, would I be able to enjoy the good work that someone who I thought, oh, this narcissist ass? No, I'd be like crying. I'd be awful. I don't even want to watch it. And the thing is, I'm honest. I would not even be able to convince myself that it's a piece of shit. It would be like, motherfucker, it's good. So holy shit, so he's actually creatively better than me? That's...
I've not run into that, by the way. So I'm only talking about people that I know who I think are not good people. Yeah. People that I don't know. It's not like I feel that way about the Coen brothers. I don't know them. Yeah. It's like I can love their movies, you know?
Well, here's what I have to say that I think it's not from wisdom. It's just from observation that, you know, this idea that fundamental wiring cannot change, but you can take actions and open your heart now more and become a good person. But all those things that you think will not change, fortunately, with age and time, will make you just a caricature of yourself. So no matter how menacing they may have been at one time, eventually you're just gonna, other people are going to be like, oh, it's kind of silly now.
Yeah, no, it's well, I do feel, as you said, I think a little bit mellowing, although there's times I feel not at all. I'm absolutely better than I was than maybe in, you know, I think I started to feel a little bit better in my 40s, you know. And also, this sounds awful. I hope that I'm healthy. I hope I live a long life. Die before anyone around me dies. That's important.
Okay. Maybe you should write that down somehow.
Yeah, and I also am taking some comfort in the fact that, you know, I'm closer to the end than I was all those other... In a weird way, I don't have a death wish, anything like that, but I'm feeling... If the human life span or expectancy is, you know, 80 some years now or something like that, I think that's just about right. If they said, no, there's this pill, you can go to 125, I wouldn't take the pill. If I'm lucky enough and I hope I am healthy enough to live a normal life expectancy, I'm happy with the number of years, I'm good.
Well, look, dude. I love you. It's a good talk, and it was a pleasure to talk to you and meet you.
I'm glad you liked the book. That means a lot to me. Thanks a lot. Thanks, buddy.
Powerful, funny, love that guy. Not the most comfortable guy in the world, but definitely hilarious and brilliant. As usual, go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get on the mailing list. Get some merch for some Christmas presents. We'll have new posters up there. The remixed music on today's show is done by DJ Copley. Our theme music is by John Montagna. Again, happy Hanukkah. Again, go to epics.com. And if you need information on how to watch my special More Later, it premiered on Friday. I don't know who watched it. A lot of people are asking if they can watch it elsewhere. I don't know. I know that it will be on Hulu in 90 days. I know that I'm proud of it. And I hope it gets to people. I know you can go to epics.com to check out where you can get it and how you can get it. I know you don't all have epics, but someday you will see it. I promise you will see it, and it will remain timeless. So, what? Guitar? I can play a little. Hanukkah guitar?
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.